they dominated us. They were better at both ends. They played harder. They played sharper. It was a humbling experience, I think, for our guys. It certainly was for me. They absolutely dominated the full 48 minutes. They won all four quarters. We never got it under double figures in the second half. I mean, they got whatever they wanted. We had no fight in us. It was a bad, bad night. They did exactly what we tried to prepare our guys for. We expected that. Disappointing that we weren't mature enough to be ready to play this game better than we were. That was disappointing.
1-0, and Springer sends a ball high and deep to right field. Puig going back at the wall, and it's gone. Opposite field home run for George Springer. Fastball line, fair ball down the right field line. Burns around third getting the wave. He'll come in to score, and the Dodgers have tied it. Here's the 1-2, and Peterson lifts a high fly ball to left field. Did he get enough? Yes, he did. Opposite field home run. Jock Peterson, third home run of the World Series. The pitch. Swing and a miss. He got him. Jensen strikes out Beltran. And partner, we're going to game 7.
Looking back at it, I'm looking at one inning. Two hits in one inning, and neither one of them were hit hard. It sucks. It's not the first time it's happened to me. It sucks that it was in the World Series in a clinching game. I'm not going to go home tonight and be like, man, I pitched horribly. I feel like I pitched pretty well, and I feel like the National League game dictated that I came out a little bit quicker than I probably would have. We'll see what happens.
I'm going to try tonight. Maybe it's going to be a little bit more adrenaline on my body. Everybody knows what game 7 means. We play a game 7. A week ago, I think 10 days ago against the Yankees, and it was pretty good. We'll see what happens.
Preparation's out the door at this point. You know, the routine's out the door. It's just, you know, there's no excuses. You just got to go get guys out as fast as you can and pitch as long as they want you to, and I'll be ready whenever they need me to. I'll be ready to go from pitch one whenever they need me to.
They take the whole body of work, and that's why Clemson is in there at number 4. That's because that loss to Syracuse was overcome by a win against Auburn, a win against Louisville, Boston College, Wake Forest. All of those teams have records above 500. And we also learned today about the undefeateds, Miami and Wisconsin. Both of those teams, clearly their weak strength of schedules weren't enough to impress the selection committee in spite of those undefeated records.
I think Georgia over Alabama is a strong message. They're going resume over reputation. Does it matter where they sit if they're both undefeated in Atlanta? The committee views Georgia as number one, and they would lose to Alabama by, 10, 14 points. Going from 1-5, would that be enough to knock them down? Being at 1 is better than being 2 going into that final week. Obviously, a long way to go between now and then.
Ohio State had a great win last weekend against Penn State. They've played really well since their loss to Oklahoma. But at this point in the season, that head-to-head matchup is important to the selection committee and will continue to be important to the selection committee. The discussion from teams 3 through 7, as passionate as any discussion that I can remember the selection committee having. When you looked at number 3, Notre Dame, 3 wins against CFP top 25 teams, only loss coming against number 1, Georgia. Clemson, impressive resume, 6 wins against teams with a winning record, 2 wins against CFP top 25 teams. Only loss, quarterback was injured, returned the following game. And then head-to-head results were important in 5, 6, and 7 for the selection committee.
Welcome to the Bob France Afternoon Extravaganza on ESPN 106.5 The Ticket.
Indeed, it is indeed an extravaganza, and you are locked into it 12 minutes after 3. Thanks for joining us right here on ESPN 106.5 The Ticket, where we are, Toledo's sports leader. What is going on? Thanks for the time. My oh my, another action-packed montage from Mr. Cushlin there, and we did not even cover within it, strangely enough. One of the goofiest, yet most entertaining, yet wretched, yet hilarious, yet pathetic, yet deserving stories of the year. That one being the botched trade for the Cleveland Browns to try to get a decent veteran starting quarterback from the Cincinnati Bengals in A.J. McCarron. How about that? We heard from Stan Van on the Pistons, big loss. You know, it's funny, they go out there and they beat up on some of the best teams in the Western Conference, including the previously undefeated Clippers and the defending champion Warriors. Then they go out against the young and rising and coming and but still very, very raw L.A. Lakers and get pounded. I guess that's what happens out on the West Coast. Sometimes it's just that way. You heard Stan Van World Series we'll talk about, too, a little bit on the college football rankings. We did not get to that Brown story, but we will. That'll be coming up at about 3:35 with our friend Scott Petrak. I want to start this afternoon's conversation with you, and we would like you to be a part of that conversation. As always, I tell you all the time, if you've got something to say, we're ready to listen. 866-240-1065. However, if you've got nothing to say and you just want to listen, that's fine, because I got plenty on my mind. So you decide if you want to be a part of the conversation or if you just want to listen. You heard the voice at the very end, probably a voice you don't know, a name you don't know. It's Kirby Hokut. Who is he? Well, he's a member of the College Football Playoff Committee. He's also from the Big 12, by the way, a Big 12 representative in the College Football Playoff Committee. He's the AD at Texas Tech in Lubbock. He was explaining some of the rationale, and that's good because there is some explaining that needs to be done. However, I got to tell you, I was pleasantly surprised by what I saw and read from the College Football Playoff Committee in their first edition, the first iteration, if you will, of this season's rankings. Pleasantly surprised because they didn't just go with the popular Alabama's better than the world that the College Football Coaches poll and the AP poll suggest that they are. Alabama's better than the world. There's no reason for anybody else to look there. They actually had Alabama number two. AP has had Bama number one really since the start of the season. Coaches poll the same. Georgia has been the consensus number two, also at 8-0. The College Football Playoff Committee said, you know what, we really like the SEC. We do like both those teams, but they actually had Georgia at number one. And Kirby Hokut delivered part of the explanation as to why that is. It's going to tick off some Bama fans, clearly. It's probably great, great motivational fuel for Nick Saban. Remember what Nick Saban said about the media? What was it, Jim Cushman, about a month ago? He said, you guys talking about my team is like rat poison.
Right. Yeah.
It's rat poison. You praise them and they start believing you instead of believing me when I tell them that they suck and they got a lot of work to do to get better.
Right, I do remember that.
And so he's probably loving life. You see that? They think Georgia's better than you are. You see that, you pathetic pieces of crap? Georgia is better than you are. And what's going to happen next week? We're going to get passed by somebody else. You know what? We're just going to slide all the way out of the top four the way we're playing. He will use the hail out of that. The debate, as passionate as the discussion for teams 3 through 7 was, you just heard Kirby Hokut say, was even more passionate for 1 and 2. It was two wins against top 25 CFP teams, and the win over number 3 Notre Dame that gave Georgia the slight edge this week. And that being consistent, by the way, assuming that they want to be consistent, and that's probably not a very good assumption. They haven't been in the past. It's one of the reasons I've complained. But if they are being consistent, that is something that should not change. If those things, and it's interesting, the way Kirby Hokut phrased that in that clip that we just heard from the montage. It's very interesting. If he meant what he said when he said that those wins over two top 25 CFP teams and the Notre Dame win, particularly over number 3 Notre Dame, gave Georgia the slight edge this week, I don't know why he needed the qualifier this week. That should be just the edge. That should not change if Georgia doesn't lose. They will have South Carolina coming up on Saturday. They will have 14th-ranked Auburn. And if they beat another, you know, top 15 team and another top 25 CFP-ranked team, and that would be, where is Auburn? They are 14th there. If they beat 14th Auburn, then Kentucky and Georgia Tech on their way to the SEC championship game, then it would stand to reason they are going to remain on top of Alabama. Alabama, however, does have top 25 games remaining themselves. They've got 19th-rated LSU. Then they've got 16th-rated Mississippi State. And finally, they also have 14th-rated Auburn. So 3 of their last 4 would be against top 25 teams. Now, if they go out and impressively win those 3 games, then maybe you can see a flip or a flop. But for me, I want to see consistency. If they believe Georgia is better now and Georgia does not lose and does not, you know, escape in one of these games by the skin of their teeth, then they should be rated over Alabama at the end. We all know that the college football playoff rankings, the first iteration of them, is not going to be the final iteration of them. The four teams that are rated in the playoffs, if the playoffs started this coming weekend, are not going to be those four teams at the end. Number one, losses will happen. Somebody among Notre Dame, Clemson at 3-4, Georgia and Alabama 1-2, somebody's going to lose. Probably multiple teams. And there are going to be some teams below them that have some incredible wins. Ohio State among them. We'll talk more about that as we continue. As a matter of fact, let me talk about Ohio State from this standpoint. Fans of the Scarlet and Gray, or in last week's game against Penn State, of the really dark gray and black. Did you like that, Cushland? We didn't even talk about that.
No, I didn't. I can't stand those.
I get it. You want to do alternate uniforms. It draws some interest, and it, you know, maybe gives you more stuff to sell in the team shop. Hey, you want to buy the dark gray jersey and all of this kind of stuff. I get it. Michigan did it with the all-maize uniforms earlier this year. Maryland does it all the time with, you know, all kinds of different weird, strange looks. But anyway, fans of the Scarlet and Gray probably really upset. Not only are they not in the top four, even after beating number two Penn State the way that they did, they are actually two spots out. They are at number six, just one spot ahead of the Nittany Lions that they took down. Who do they trail? How about the committee taking the advice of one Baker Mayfield? Baker Mayfield, quarterback at Oklahoma, who engineered a tremendous road victory at the Horseshoe in the second week of the season, and then famously planted the Oklahoma flag right there on the turf at the Horseshoe, ticking a lot of people off. As a matter of fact, he had to apologize for that later on, or at least he didn't have to, but he did. But Baker Mayfield said that there's no way Ohio State should be rated ahead of us, and they were ranked ahead of Oklahoma, in fact, precipitously so, in the AP Top 25. Ohio State third, Oklahoma eighth. That's a gap of five if you're not very good at math. Then in the coaches poll, third and ninth, so a gap of six. But when the playoff committee got together, they said, you know, our eyes don't deceive us. We're not supposed to. And this is where the committee comes into some really, really dangerous water. What I mean by that, there's 12 different committee members, right, Kush?
Yes.
12 committee members who arguably have 12 different sets of criteria as to who and how they rank these teams. What the committee seemed to say, at least the majority of them as they made their rankings this week, is that we don't ignore what our eyes tell us we saw. And we saw Oklahoma and Ohio State head-to-head, and we saw Oklahoma beat them and beat them very, very convincingly. What was it in Columbus? 33-16, I think? I mean, they beat them by three scores.
31-16.
All right, fair enough. So they beat them by 15 points. So I look at that, and I say, okay, the committee is taking head-to-head into account. They're also taking head-to-head into account when it comes to Ohio State and Penn State, two
right.
Very, very highly rated one-loss teams. And guess what? One beat the other, so there it is, 6-7. But what this committee has done in previous years, and this is only the fourth year of the college football playoffs, so let's be, you know, real about this. What the committee has done in previous years is they have changed their criteria later on. Instead of we know what we saw, and we're not going to not believe our lying eyes, they go to, well, but how have they played since then, and who would win today?
Right.
And they play the speculation game. And the speculation among a lot of people, including the pollsters for the AP and for the college, the coaches poll, the speculation is Ohio State would beat Oklahoma rather convincingly now. And they have to guess that. They have to put all of that into their computers, et cetera, rather than believing their own eyes from week number two. And the question will become then, how much of that speculation will they do to give Ohio State the cred and not Oklahoma, just to give those two teams as an example? And how much will they, how much stock will they put into undefeated teams over one-loss teams based on perceived strength of schedule? As you heard, who was that? I think it was Heather Dinich talking about strength of schedule. Because ranked way ahead of two undefeated teams in Power 5 conferences, 8-0 Wisconsin and 7-0 Miami, are 5-1 loss teams. Or is it six? Correction, six. Notre Dame, Clemson, Oklahoma, Ohio State, Penn State, and TCU, all 7-1 and all ranked over 8-0 Wisconsin and 7-0 Miami. So when the committee has to come together again, not just this coming Tuesday for the next round, and they'll do this all throughout the month of November, but when they put it together after the conference championship weekend in the first week of December, for Saturday in December, they're going to have to say, what about the record? Then what about the body of work? Then what about the head-to-head results? And does a head-to-head result in early September mean as much in early December as it did back then, Kush?
Yeah, and that's obviously going to be something that they're going to have to, you know, address as we keep going forward and keeping that. But for right now, I do kind of like some of, you know, some of what they did, because they could have organized these one-loss teams in a whole bevy of different ways, really, but they stuck with what they've but I liked how you worked that. As opposed to playing the speculation game, they played the what have our eyes already seen kind of game, and in that's why even I don't really have a big problem right now with 5-6-7 Oklahoma, Ohio State, Penn State. Oklahoma beat Ohio State, Ohio State beat Penn State. Basically, they all have one loss and all have seven wins. That's where they should be.
And that's all if they're very, very closely, you know, ranked anyway.
Then
they're
all very
highly regarded. Then you go to head-to-head. Now, it's not like, hey, well, Clemson, you lost to Syracuse. How come Syracuse isn't rated above Clemson? No. Because Syracuse has lost other games,
right,
and they're not on that level. But if you have teams that are kind of grouped together in a high fashion, then you say, all right, let's settle it on the field. And let's settle it by way of conference championships as well. And that is, I think, the right way to do it.
Yeah, and I'm glad you mentioned the Clemson part, too, because I can imagine some people in Coral Gables flipping out right now. Well, why is Clemson, fellow ACC team, way up there at number 4 and we're at number 10? We're undefeated. Because you haven't played anybody yet. Really.
Right.
Look at Miami's schedule. They have more or less, same with Wisconsin. Despite how good they seem, in fact, let's put it this way, Bob. Because of Florida State falling off, I would argue that the best game for Miami so far was the win against the Rockets.
Wow, that's interesting.
Because I have North Carolina, Syracuse, Georgia Tech, at Duke, at Florida State.
Well, remember, they did beat a Syracuse team that beat Clemson.
True.
So maybe that's a little bit more of a win than perhaps you might want to give it credit for.
Possibly, but then again, they win at Florida State, and usually that's a big thing, but clearly we see that they are completely off this year in their preseason rank of, what was it, number 3, is totally, you know, worthless. Miami, you're getting your shot, because this week they get 13th-ranked Virginia Tech at home, and then the week after that, on the 11th, they get Notre Dame.
And that's the key. That is exactly right there. You know, I thought Mike and Mike this morning both did a pretty good job of explaining this. If you're Miami, if you're down there in Coral Gables going, wait, what? We're undefeated, an undefeated Power 5 conference team, and you've got us down here ranked below these teams, all of these teams?
While also noting that another ACC team with one loss is in the top 4 in Clemson.
Right, exactly. They're going to be really upset about that we're down at 10. But as Mike and Mike, I thought, did a really good job of pointing out, they do control their destiny. In large part, you beat 13th-ranked Virginia Tech, your Hokies, Kush, and then you beat number 3 Notre Dame. You do that in back-to-back weeks. That committee will take you from ranked 10th at 8-0 to definitely ranked in the top 4 at 10-0.
No question.
There's no doubt in my mind. Notre Dame, of course, will fall out of it. Virginia Tech is not in it, but it's an extraordinarily high-quality win. Incidentally, where is Virginia Tech on the rank? 13th, there it is.
Yeah, they're number 13.
Football playoff rankings as well. So I was thinking of those being poll rankings, but no, those are all CFP rankings. So, yeah, so they control their own destiny to some extent. And as the guys this morning pointed out as well, and I'm often quick to criticize these guys when they say things that I think are ridiculously stupid. I also praise them when they're right. Wisconsin, not so much. Wisconsin does not have a quality win really anywhere, and they might not have any coming up. I mean, Wisconsin has an 8-0 record, and their non-conference schedule just is nothing at all to get excited about. The team that was supposed to be a big non-conference opponent for them didn't turn out to be one because BYU is terrible. But that doesn't mean, you know, we talk about all the time about how they schedule these games years in advance. Mm-hmm. You think, okay, that's going to be a big challenge. On the road, you know, at Provo, we'll go to Utah and play BYU, and it'll be a quality win if we get it. And they beat them 40-6, but BYU is nothing. And then they've played their Big Ten schedule, and they've played nobody. And this is not their fault that these Big Ten teams are weak.
I know. I'm looking at it right now. I can't decide if Maryland or Northwestern is their quote-unquote most impressive win.
And guess what? None of them are like blowouts.
No.
I mean, well, you know, 38-17, that's what? That's that's a 21-point blowout. So, okay, of Nebraska. It's a 3-touchdown win. But still, 33-24 over Northwestern. Then the Nebraska game I just mentioned. Purdue only 17-9. Maryland 38-13. That's a 25-point win. I guess it's better than it looks when you just see the score. And then Illinois 24-10, just by a couple of touchdowns, and they're terrible. Mm-hmm. And what do they have? Indiana, that's not going to boost them up the rankings.
Nope.
Iowa, a win there, isn't going to boost them.
Nope.
Michigan, who's outside of the top 25, not going to give as much juice to their resume as perhaps it should in another year. And then Minnesota, again, not going to help them. The only thing Wisconsin can hope for is to finish that table against those four teams, and quite frankly, they should, and then win the Big Ten Conference championship game.
Yep.
You win the Big Ten championship game, and even though your strength of schedule will be garbage, hot, steaming garbage, you will be an undefeated Power 5 conference champion.
It's the only chance
they
got.
There's no way the committee, even if they're much, much, much more impressed with the likes of Bama, whoever wins Bama and Georgia in the their conference championship game, Notre Dame, if they take care of their business, Clemson, Miami, as we talked about, depending on the Miami and Notre Dame outcome, there's no way they're going to bump Wisconsin over, they're going to keep one of those teams with one loss over Wisconsin because of the status of a Power 5 conference champion with a zero in the loss column. That's the only way it can work for Wisconsin. They would have to win the Big Ten championship.
Completely agree. They have no chance unless they go undefeated and win the Big Ten, because unless, whether it's the college rankings or any of the other polls, unless 2.5 weeks from now for that November 18th game in Madison against Michigan, unless Michigan's a ranked team, how's this for messed up? They could go all the way to the Big Ten title game and not play a single ranked team.
Yeah.
That's crazy.
It just so happens, you know, they're on the same side of the conference, obviously, Ohio State, but they don't play them this year.
Right.
So that would have been, of course, a feather in their cap to be able to do that and then beat the West Division champion. But unfortunately for them.
No, they are in that division.
I'm sorry?
Wisconsin's in that opposite division. That's why they don't have any ranked opponents.
Oh, you're right. I'm sorry. That's why they don't. I'm looking at it wrong.
Yeah, I'm looking at it. They're quote-unquote crossover.
Correct. They're not in the Ohio State side. They are in the West.
Exactly.
The only chance they would have is to beat either Penn State or Ohio State, the East champion,
yep,
in the conference championship.
That would be their only ranked opponent all year.
That would be the only one. That's exactly right. You know, like I said, the Michigan, just from a, you know, from a street cred standpoint and the fact that they have a really good defense, the committee might look at that and say, okay, we're impressed by that, but it will not be, just very simply, it will not be a win over a ranked team. So if you look at it from a strictly a numbers criteria, that will not give them the boost. It will only do that if the committee says, yeah, well, Michigan is still Michigan.
Right.
That's about the only way. Okay, here we go. Let's get our wild stat.
ESPN 106.5 The Ticket presents the Wild Stat of the Day, brought to you by Buffalo Wild Wings. Wings, beer, sports.
Wild Stat tonight will be the 43rd all-time Game 7 of the World Series, Dodgers and Astros. All-time, the home team and the road team split down the middle as the winners. Nobody has an advantage tonight. The home teams have won. Well, hold on a second here, Jim. I'm going to give the wild stat that you gave me, but I'm just going to do it with a raised eyebrow. Home team has won Game 7 20 times, while road teams have been victorious in 22. However, beginning in 1980, it has favored the home team as they have won 9 straight from 82 to 2011, and the last two Game 7s have been won by the road team. So that's the wild stat as presented by Jim Cushlin. It's a little bit different than the wild stat I heard this morning on Mike and Mike. So somewhere along the line, there are some stats that have been crossed over. If I can fix that, I will, and clarify it on the other side. Let's get a bottom of the hour sports center with Mr. Cushlin. Then we'll talk to Scott Petrak about the greatest embarrassment in all of team sports, the can't get out of their own way embarrassing Cleveland Browns. That's coming up right here on the Ticket.
you were young.
Now back to the Bob France Extravaganza, ESPN 106.5 The Ticket.
It's possible, it's mind-boggling, but possible. The fact that it went right up to the deadline is mind-boggling as well. Organizations that are professionally run, like the Patriots, made the Garoppolo trade well before the deadline. Organizations like the Bills and the Jaguars that are professionally run made the Darius trade long before the deadline. There's a reason for that. You know that the deadline is there. You know things can go wrong. You know that Murphy's Law almost always applies. If something can go wrong, it will.
I got to tell you, that's one of the most scathing critiques, without being scathing, that I think you can possibly get in the National Football League. Bill Polian had been one of the most respected executives in the league, still is now as an analyst. And Bill Polian just called the Cleveland Browns and, to a lesser extent, the Cincinnati Bengals unprofessional. That's what he called them, by talking about the professionalism of those other teams that he mentioned who made deals before the trade deadline. Perhaps that's why the Bengals and the Browns are a combined 3-12 this season and are essentially garbage in their own division. Joining us now to break down the incredibly embarrassing mess going on out in Cleveland with the clowns is Scott Petrak, who's been a Clowns beat writer for many, many years and probably has never earned his salary more than he's earning at covering this mess in 2017. Scott, how are you, sir?
I'm okay, Bob. How are you?
I'm good, man. How do you, as a writer, do you love the fact that you constantly have material with these clowns? Or, I mean, because it's almost like a comedian, you know? I mean, a lot of great comedians take their material and they make it out of real-life events. For a beat writer, you have so much material to choose from with all of these controversies and stories with these idiots, and you don't have to hunt for meaningless stats to fill up sidebars and ancillary stories to your main game story. Scott, do you enjoy this, or does this bring you pain to have to cover a team with so much ineptitude?
Yeah, from a selfish standpoint, it's a little bit of both, Bob. You like the fact that they're in the news, so that keeps interest level higher than normal for a team that never wins. But it's, you know, when you never know what's going to happen, it makes for a little bit of a tough, home life. You know, you have something planned and then all of a sudden a trade like this gets destroyed and it becomes the news of the night and you're trying to chase it down and figure it out. And it, you know, it eats into your Halloween or it eats into your bye week. You know, I'd be happy with mundane bye week or mundane off season every once in a while, but I guess I shouldn't complain.
You know, that's fair. That's fair. That's well reasoned, and I certainly can understand that. But from a professional standpoint, again, you never have to reach and scratch for stories because they're just giving them to you, including this one yesterday. Now, as I watch this thing unfold on Twitter, you know, I get stories from Schefter this, and you know, all these different NFL insiders and so on and so forth. Everybody has a different explanation or a source telling them this is why the trade didn't get called into the NFL for approval in time by the Browns, and this one is, and this one is. And one of the ones that I saw recurring was that they literally agreed to the deal with the Bengals for A.J. McCarron to send a second and a third to the Bengals for the backup quarterback of the Bengals at 355. And they were so excited about it, so jubilant about it, they were celebrating and celebrated past 4 o'clock without picking up the phone to call the league offices or pushing send on an email saying we've agreed to this deal for approval. Is that true to your understanding, Scott? Was this a celebration gone too long that cost them this deal?
No. I think of all the speculation that's out there, that's mm-hmm. one of the ones that I'm least buying into. You know, I've talked to people with both organizations, and that wasn't it. You know, you can make other arguments about why it didn't come to fruition, but the Browns sent an email to the Bengals in time. The Browns say they
what time are we talking about?
Like 6 minutes to four. Okay. Like 3:54, 3:55.
All right.
Expected the Bengals to therefore sign the document and forward it to the league office. The Bengals just did their own document saying this is a trade we had, expecting the Browns to do so as well. And that's what Bill Polian was saying, that the Browns should have just said, hey, this is a trade, send it to the league. Both teams independently send it to the league. You call the follow-up, and then you have a trade. Then down the road, you go ahead and you have the official document in triplicate, like Bill Polian said, one goes to each team, one goes to the league office. So I don't have an explanation for why the Browns didn't get theirs into the league and why they sent one to Cincinnati, but I know that they did send it to Cincinnati. Cincinnati initially had said, no, that wasn't the case, but then they actually saw the email. It wasn't from who they expected it, but they got it yesterday afternoon.
From whom did they get it?
One of the people in Sashi's front office, but not from Sashi Brown himself.
Okay, this might even be more embarrassing than the celebration story that a lot of reporters get told. I mean, honestly. So Sashi Brown delegates the responsibility to get this official confirmation of the deal from their side to a subordinate who sends that information not to the league but to Cincinnati, expecting Cincinnati will see it and say, yeah, we agree, and then, hey, Cincy, you turn it in for us. It sounds like a couple of kids in a sixth-grade classroom doing a group project. Did anybody turn it in? I thought you were going to turn it in. No, I thought you were going to turn it in. We told Joey to turn it in. Joey, you didn't turn it in, and you all got Fs. That's what this sounds like, Scott. They expected the Bengals to turn in the work instead of sending it into the teacher, in this case, the league office themselves.
Yeah, I hear what you're saying, and, you know, you can't argue, because the fact is the trade didn't get done. So, therefore, somebody's to blame, and the Bengals are putting the blame on the Browns, you know, chiefly. It's the Browns' fault they didn't send it in, and many league experts, like Bill Polian, agree with that assessment. So the Browns look terrible, and they usually look terrible, and are 0-8 and 1-23, and like 3-33 or something the last 35 years.
Yesterday, I was talking to our mutual friend Maniloff, who said that since November of 2014, we can go all the way out in 4-41.
You can pick all the stats. I'm writing a story right now. I stopped at 2-33. I thought that was bad enough over the last 35.
No, go to 4-41. It's worse, because then it's only one more win and nine more losses. Or eight more losses.
So, they look terrible. Again, they're the laughing stock of the league. The hang up for me is that Sashi Brown, you know, you can argue whether or not how valuable a Harvard education is, but he's a Harvard educated guy. I've talked to him dozens of times. He's a smart guy. He doesn't make these kinds of mistakes. And he's made, by my counting, 16 trades in the last 22 months. And he's made them on the clock during the draft. And those have the same kind of time restrictions that a trade deadline deal would. So for him to get it wrong, it just doesn't smell right. You know, it feels like he's not the kind of guy that they're going to make a procedural error. And therefore you wonder if there was an ulterior motive, if they weren't that confident about getting the trade in, or were they just incompetent? You know, and frankly, none of those possibilities or none of those options make them look good. And, you know, all those options could get him fired.
Well, is what the Bengals, to your understanding, from people you've talked to, is their story accurate that they expected an email from Sashi and they didn't get it from Sashi, they got it from a subordinate and so they didn't look at it? Is that accurate?
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, I've been told that directly.
Well,
that's what happened.
Pardon my directness on this, but then fire him. Because then it is on him. He's the not general manager. What's his title? Executive vice president in charge of football operations or president of football operations, whatever he is. It is on him. If he gave this to a subordinate didn't get it done, and this embarrassment falls to them, and this trade falls through, and they don't get the quarterback they wanted, blah, blah, blah. Ultimately, it is a circus. I mean, cue the Benny Hill music. Here's the Browns' offices, literally their offices, with people running in circles around the fax machine, the computer. Did anybody send it? I mean, I'm just listening to the yakety sacks right now and saying, this is Cleveland Browns football. Play like a Brown.
Yeah, I mean, it's hard to argue with that, Bob. And especially, you know, if it were a one-off, you know, oh, man, this never happens. The Browns are a respected organization. I mean, Denver had a snafu years ago with Elvis Dumervil, where he's to be a free agent, and they screwed up the fax machine, and they don't get him signed, he becomes
That's
a free
right.
agent, whatever. Right? But they're Denver. They've won Super Bowls.
Right?
They're a well-run organization. You go, oh, that
happened. It's not par for their course.
Exactly. When it's the Browns, it's, here we go again. How many things can you screw up? And I'm with you. You know, I mean, I don't call for people to get fired, but this is, to me, one of those moments where If you're the owner and you're Jimmy Haslam and Dee Haslam and you're in that building today, it would be hard not to want to fire somebody.
Well, you'd have to be asking even harder questions. If you're 20-22 in your last 42 games, Scott, then this isn't a fireable offense. When you're, as you said, what is it, 2-32 and 4-41, yeah. I think is what I had in the last 45 games. When that's your record, and it's already looking awful, and you've already been excoriated publicly for passing on Carson Wentz to collect all of these assets, passing on Deshaun Watson because you don't trust him, and all of these things that have gone on, when you add all of this up, this kind of thing is just, all right, that's it. That's the straw that broke the Haslam's back. Get out. Everybody get out. We're starting over.
Yeah, I mean, I can't argue with that, Bob, and I'm sitting by my phone and I'm texting people to see if something's going to happen today, you know. Now, I don't think Jimmy Haslam was leaning toward making any drastic moves before this. You know, I think 0-8, he was willing to say, okay, I'm giving you the last 8 games. Try to show me some progress so I don't have to blow this thing up, so I can stick to some semblance of stability and continuity. And I think he's going to have to reevaluate that. I think he is reevaluating that. Yeah. In light of what happened yesterday, and that makes all the sense in the world. And, you know, then it becomes, you know, do I even bother giving them the rest of the season to try to do something? You know, and that's what the McCarron trade would have been about. I didn't like the trade at all. I thought they would overpay for a guy that I don't think could be a franchise quarterback.
I want to talk about the nuts and bolts of the trade itself and whether or not he was worth those 2 picks anyway, because I'm in agreement with you, by the way. But I don't want to address that part yet. I want to go to the coaches and the front office. The other storyline here that has kind of worked its way through the media, both traditional and social, over the course of the last, you know, 12 hours, is that Hugh Jackson and the coaching staff was irate that the front office let the Garoppolo deal go down to the Bengals, or to the Niners, I should say, the day before all of this went down, that they were irate. You know, the Browns are sitting here with what? 2 1s next year, 3 2s, a 3, 2 4s, 2 5s, 2 6s. They got all of these assets because they kept passing on potential franchise quarterbacks and trading down. How the hell are we not using a couple of those to sweeten the deal to Belichick? To take that deal away from San Francisco, who got out of it with just 1 second-round pick. Word is they were irate. That's a word I've seen many, many times. Is that accurate?
Nobody's told me irate. I know that Hugh Jackson wanted Jimmy Garoppolo for some time now. I know that seeing him go to San Francisco for a second-round pick, when Hugh Jackson's roster of quarterbacks includes no one who's won a game in the NFL, doesn't make him happy. And I think it's just the latest example of friction and conflict between the coaching staff and the front office, Bob. And I think we saw another example of it with the trade, the failed trade yesterday. Is Hugh Jackson keeps saying, and he's saying it publicly, my roster's not good enough. I can't win with the guys you gave me. And he made a final plea yesterday. Get me a quarterback that I've had some success with, that I might be able to win some games and might be able to save my job. And for whatever reason, however it went down, Sashi Brown was not able to do that again yesterday for Hugh Jackson. And that's why I think the coaching staff has every right to be irate. And if you're a Browns fan, and on top of Carson Wentz and Deshaun Watson getting away, and not only getting away, being given away.
Yes, literally.
Watch Jimmy Garoppolo. Right. And to watch Jimmy Garoppolo, the guy you've been connected to since the end of last season, sign seemingly out of the blue, or get traded out of the blue for just a second-round pick, it's just another huge black mark against Sashi Brown and his ability to evaluate and prioritize quarterbacks.
Well, now let's talk about that part of this, Scott. We're talking to Scott Petrak, Browns beat writer. Sashi didn't have to evaluate all of these things, right? This was not his wheelhouse. This guy's a lawyer. This guy isn't a lifetime personnel, a scout and then personnel director or player personnel director or assistant personnel director. He has no long-term experience in this. That's where Paul DePodesta was coming in. He was coming in with his hot little computer, and he was going to bang all the numbers out and analyze his way to, this is the best way to build a championship team. This shows that this guy's not worth taking, and it's better to trade it down for the picks, and et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. It was supposed to be DePodesta that was going to be the wonder kid here. Now, again, it's only been, you know, parts of 2 seasons here, but it's not, if it's not just Sashi, And it's not just Podesta, it's both of them. And in my estimation, they both ought to go because they are the ones who put their little heads together and said, nah, Carson Wentz won't play well here. Nah, Deshaun Watson isn't the Michael Jordan that Dabo Swinney said he would be, and he is proving to be down there in Houston. These are the guys. I mean, you know, what's Dee Podesta's value to this team, you know, this this baseball scout in a football office?
Yeah, I'm fine with that conclusion. You know, he's a key strategy officer. He's supposed to oversee every process within the organization, which means, you know, from soup to nuts, are we doing this right? Are we not doing it right? How can we do it better? And that included the draft process. It included free agency. It included how the scouts scouted. And it increased the emphasis and the reliance upon analytics. And Sashi Brown was good with that, and Jimmy Haslam was good with that, and Hugh Jackson said he was good with that. And it spits out Cody Kessler in the third round. It spits out Carson Wentz is not a top 20. We don't think he'll be a top 20 quarterback. It says Deshaun Watson is not worth the number 12 pick in the draft. And therefore, it's those guys making that those decisions with that information that they both combined to get, and that's where the Browns are right now. So, yeah, I think the whole process is flawed. And the thing is, Dee Podesta is not a football guy, so they lack
right.
a football guy with significant say. You know, Hugh Jackson has tried to fill that void. I don't think they've given him quite enough power. There's been some back and forth. I believe Hugh Jackson had significant say on taking Myles Garrett instead of Mitch Trubisky with the number one pick in the draft. But, you know, every organization starts off on the same page. These guys seem to be off the same page pretty quickly. And there was conflict on how to build the roster, and we've just seen it repeatedly.
Scott Petrak is our guest. Now let's get to the actual player involved here. They didn't make an offer of a second and maybe a third, for example, to get Garoppolo to sweeten the deal and take Belichick away from the San Francisco deal, but they decided that A.J. McCarron, a fifth-round draft pick in the same draft that Garoppolo was a second-round draft pick, and nowhere near as highly regarded by most league scouts and general managers as Garoppolo, as being a potential franchise guy, maybe a good quality backup to Dalton down there in Cincinnati. But then, now they're going to go ahead and give up a second and a third. It's almost, you know, they did it out of desperation because they knew how bad they looked by not making the Garoppolo deal, and they were willing to do something worse, and maybe the accident of, you know, not getting it turned in time will turn out to be for the better, because I don't know that A.J. McCarron is worth a two and a three.
No, I'm with you. And to me, it's a panic move, and it's a desperation move, like you said. I think they realized that they should have made a better offer for Garoppolo. I'm not even sure they were in on the Garoppolo deal at the end. I know that they made offers around the draft, you know, and inquired since the draft, but I can't tell you that Monday they made a better offer to Belichick and was turned down. You know, he wound up in San Francisco for a number of reasons, but they see that, the coaching staff sees that, isn't happy about it, is trying to do everything it can to save its jobs, and that's why A.J. McCarron was a possibility. But I don't think he's worth a second and a three, especially considering Garoppolo went for only a second.
Right.
And I don't think he's a long-term guy. I don't think he's a long-term franchise quarterback. Therefore, it doesn't make sense. So given that you don't have Garoppolo, I would have, and this is going to be their alternative now, but I would have played Deshaun Kizer for the final eight games. I like more than a lot of people do. I'm not saying he gives you a chance to win in Detroit coming out of the bye, but I think he's got potential to be a franchise quarterback. Playing for the last eight games, it's a lost season. And I think Hugh Jackson especially got sucked into, I have to save my job, I need to win. A.J. McCarron would give me a better chance to win multiple games coming down the stretch. Let's go get him. And the front office obliged, seemingly obliged, because of all those things we mentioned. The Garoppolo deal, the other quarterback mishaps, 0-8, Jimmy Haslam's history of impatience. And it led to almost dealing for A.J. McCarron. Then it fell through. I think when the draft comes around in April, everybody's going to say, hey, I'm glad we had those picks.
Yeah, and everybody will until they start making them. And, you know, they've had what? did I have this right? Did they have they drafted like 24 players in the last two seasons combined? Is it the number?
Exactly, 24.
24 yep. players in the last. That's half a roster. They've been able to fill through the draft. And how many impact players have there been out of those 24 in their first 2 years in the league, in their first 1 or 2 years, depending on which year it is? I mean, look at Myles Garrett, and he's going to be one, certainly. He's only played a couple of games. And you've, as you said, Kaiser certainly has potential. We are high, and again, I'm sitting here, you know, in Toledo, Ohio. A lot of people are very excited about Deshaun, and I like his upside too. But I mean, overall, we know the numbers. We know the number of players that they have picked that have just not panned out, and the number of players they skipped over to make, to trade down for those new picks or those extra picks who have turned out to be stars elsewhere. So, you know, this. I don't know, Scott. All of the stones that we've been throwing here at Sashi Brown and Paul DePodesta, and the ones that are also deserving of Hugh Jackson, who has totally mismanaged, I believe, and mangled Deshaun Kaiser's rookie season with his yo-yoing of him. At the end of the day, Jimmy Haslam was responsible for them all. He's the one who hired a non-experienced guy to run his football program, a lawyer named Sashi Brown, and he's the one who chose to bring a baseball scout in and tell him to try to work his magic in football. And if it doesn't work at the end of the day, it's on Jimmy Haslam, and I can't help but wonder if this franchise wouldn't be better served if you put it up on the block.
Yeah, I mean, you're right, Bob. He's a guy at the top of the food chain. He deserves the blame, and I think the moves to Sashi Brown and Paul DePodesta were a bit of desperation too. Like, man, I've tried a bunch of other stuff. I tried Joe Banner. I tried Ray Farmer. Let's try this analytics-based approach with these non-football guys, see if it works. And now it feels like Jimmy Haslam's back to the drawing board, and I just don't know where he goes from here. You know, I mean, there's always going to be options. Guys are always looking to run football teams and to be coaches on football teams. There's just not a high, it's like when Sashi's drafting, there's not a high confidence level he's going to get it right. And when Jimmy's picking who's going to run his team, there's not a high confidence level he's going to get it right.
That's a staggering thing. It really, really is. It's a staggering thing when you think about it at every level, from ownership to management to decision-making on the field and the way they handle personnel. It's just an amazing thing. That's why I've said what I've said for so long about the worst-run franchise literally for 20 years in all of team sports. Scott, really great stuff. Keep up the good work. Sorry they got you, your family life and private life are so jacked up because you never know when they're going to do some other circus move that you've got to hustle debris to cover. So we really appreciate you taking the time today.
Thanks, buddy.
All right, thank you, Scott. Scott Petrak, follow him on BrownsZone.com. BrownsZone.com. Read his work there. It is tremendous. And by the way, don't forget about the Border Battle Contest. You realize it's coming down to the nitty-gritty here. Our giveaway party is actually 15 days away, and I'm talking about the Border Battle between Ohio State and Michigan, because the ticket in Yingling have a chance for you to attend that game November 25th in Ann Arbor with limo service from Total Image Limousine. Runner-up gets a trip for two to the Big Ten Championship game December 2nd at Lucas Oil. Register online at 1065theticket.com one time, or text the word Border Battle to 64636. And if you are a qualifier, you'll attend our giveaway party to see if you win one of those top two prizes Thursday night, November 16th at the Blarney downtown. Brought to you by Yingling, the Treehouse of Munch, Getco Transportation, Churchill's, Country Hearth, TAS Electronics, Distracted Haunted House, and your friends here at ESPN 106.5 The Ticket. All right, top of the hour, local sports center coming your way. Pistons talk with DetroitBadBoys.com coming up next right here on The Ticket.
It's possible, it's mind-boggling, but possible. The fact that it went right up to the deadline is mind-boggling as well. Organizations that are professionally run, like the Patriots, made the Garoppolo trade well before the deadline. Organizations like the Bills and the Jaguars that are professionally run made the Darius trade long before the deadline. There's a reason for that. You know that the deadline is there. You know things can go wrong. You know that Murphy's Law almost always applies. If something can go wrong, it will.
Looking back at it, I'm looking at one inning. Two hits in one inning, and neither one of them were hit hard. It sucks. It's not the first time it's happened to me. It sucks that I was in the World Series in a clinching game. I'm not going to go home tonight and be like, man, I pitched horribly. I feel like I pitched pretty well, and I feel like the National League game dictated that I came out a little bit quicker than I probably would have. We'll see what happens.
I'm going to try to not. Maybe it's going to be a little bit more adrenaline on my body. Everybody knows what Game 7 means. We played a Game 7 a week ago, I think 10 days ago against the Yankees, and it was pretty good. We'll see what happens.
Preparation's out the door at this point. You know, the routine's out the door. It's just, you know, there's no excuses. You just got to go get guys out as fast as you can and pitch as long as they want you to, and I'll be ready whenever they need me to.
They take the whole body of work, and that's why Clemson is in there at number four. That's because that loss to Syracuse was overcome by a win against Auburn, a win against Louisville, Boston College, Wake Forest, All of those teams have records above 500. And we also learned today about the undefeateds, Miami and Wisconsin. Both of those teams, clearly their weak strength of schedules weren't enough to impress the selection committee in spite of those undefeated records.
I think Georgia over Alabama is a strong message. They're going resume over reputation. Does it matter where they sit if they're both undefeated in Atlanta? The committee views Georgia as number one, and they would lose to Alabama by, I don't know, 10, 14 points. Going from 1 to 5, would that be enough to knock them down? Being at 1 is better than being 2 going into that final week. Obviously, a long way to go between now and then.
Ohio State had a great win last weekend against Penn State. They've played really well since their loss to Oklahoma. But at this point in the season, that head-to-head matchup is important to the selection committee and will continue to be important to the selection committee. The discussion from teams 3 through 7, as passionate as any discussion that I can remember the selection committee having. When you looked at number 3, Notre Dame, 3 wins against CFP top 25 teams, only loss coming against number 1, Georgia. Clemson, impressive resume, 6 wins against teams with a winning record, 2 wins against CFP top 25 teams. Only loss, quarterback was injured, returned the following game. And then head-to-head results were important in 5, 6, and 7 for the selection committee.
They dominated us. They were better at both ends. They played harder. They played sharper. It was a humbling experience, I think, for our guys. It certainly was for me. They absolutely dominated the full 48 minutes. They won all 4 quarters. We never got it under double figures in the second half. I mean, they got whatever they wanted. We had no fight in us. It was a bad, bad night. They did exactly what we tried to prepare our guys for. We expected that. Disappointing that we weren't mature enough to be ready to play this game better than we were. That was disappointing.
This is the Bob France Afternoon Extravaganza on ESPN 106.5 The Ticket.
Yes, indeed. As we roll onward, it's 4:17. Thanks for joining us for the extravaganza, the montage, a very, very thorough one. We got World Series issues. We got to talk about the mess in Cleveland with the Browns. But now let's talk about something positive for the first couple of weeks of the National Basketball Association season. And that, of course, has been the surprising play of the Detroit Pistons, who went out west and did some incredible work, taking down the previously undefeated Clippers, then taking down the defending champion Warriors in their building, before getting blown out by the Los Angeles Lakers by 20 yesterday. And that's why we bring in the new editor of DetroitBadBoys.com. You know, oftentimes we'll talk to Sean Corp and we'll talk to other writers and contributors, but Steve Hinson is the editor now of DetroitBadBoys.com, an SB Nation site devoted to the Pistons. And Steve joins us now right here on The Ticket in Toledo. Hey, Steve, thanks for the time, man. How are you?
Oh, doing well. How are you?
I'm outstanding. Thanks very much. Hey, you know, before we talk about the mess yesterday and then the loss to the Lakers, as ugly as it was, you kind of almost, I don't want to say you write that off. We don't want to do that, but the sting is taken out of a loss like that to an undermanned or building or rebuilding team or whatever it is you want to call the Lakers these days by the fact that they took down the Clippers and they took down the Warriors in their building in the 2 previous games. As a matter of fact, at 5-3, they still sit atop the Central Division and are among the top in the entire Eastern Conference. So let's shine a spotlight on the positive first. And just through 8 games, 5-3, what has led to this very impressive and to many surprising start for the Warriors, Steve? Or, excuse me, for the Pistons, Steve?
Oh, well, you know, it was a great week in the basketball. It was pretty cool seeing them take down both the Clippers and the Warriors. The offense is looking about as good as we've seen it under the Stan Van Gundy era. I think one of the consistent things that we saw with both the Clippers and the Warriors game was they dug themselves into the hole like they've had a tendency to do this season and last year, but they really showed a lot of resolve in cutting away that comeback and just going in and putting the pedal to the metal in the late in the third and the fourth quarters, cutting away those leads and just showing a lot of resolve and determination and getting back into that game.
What is it that you've seen in Tobias Harris that has made him erupt and be this team's scoring leader throughout this season thus far? And again, we know it's only an 8-game sample, but boy, oh boy, you know, the contributions of the likes of Avery Bradley were expected. I think he's expected to do probably even more than what he is doing. Reggie Jackson, fully healthy, is expected to be better too. But Tobias Harris is really, I don't want to say he wasn't expected to play well, but I think he's exceeded expectations thus far.
You know, I think he's gotten a lot of opportunity. I think that he's really been a big beneficiary of the ball movement. He's always been a guy who has been really versatile in his career. He's always been someone who can score in a lot of different ways. And this year, I feel like with taking away some of the emphasis of the Andre Drummond post-ups and getting him working more in the up at the top of the key and getting the ball just kind of moving from side to side in a way that's always been talked about as a goal but never really practiced as long as Stan Van Gundy's been here, has really helped out Tobias Harris in a lot of ways. It seems like he's receiving the ball while the defense has a lot going on, where it's moving, where he's able to read and react the situation in a way that he does really well. And it also helps that he's been knocking down his three-pointer in a way that he never has early throughout his career. He's hitting at 43.8% right now, which is a lot better than he's ever done. But those three-pointers that he's been putting up have looked really good and sustainable, coming in some good catch-and-shoot situations. I think we saw a few times where he was getting some challenged looks that he was still able to knock down, but overall, it seems to be hitting him in a sweet spot that's really working for his game.
Well, you know what's interesting is how many of those he's taking. As a matter of fact, if you look at his total, you said he's getting more opportunities, and you're right. Career, he averages 11 shots a game, 11 field goal attempts a game. This season, through 8 games, he's averaging 17, so he's shooting six times more at a higher clip, by the way, at 48% from the floor. But career-wise, he's averaging under 3 three-point attempts per game, and now he's shooting double that. He's shooting 6 three-pointers a game, as you point out, at nearly 44% compared to his career average of around 33%. So he's getting more shots overall and more shots from three. So clearly, you know, Stan Van Gundy has told him, do not be shy. Do not be gun-shy. Take that. We know you can knock that shot down.
Mm-hmm. And I think it's really come from a lot of that, just the ball zipping around. He's always had a great chemistry with Ish Smith, and I think Reggie Jackson's been doing a nice job at focusing on not necessarily just creating for himself, but giving his teammates an opportunity to get their own looks too. I mean, Tobias, he's leading the team in shot attempts by a few shots per game, whereas last year we saw a pretty even distribution, and Reggie Jackson's actually third on the team in shot attempts right now. So it's really benefited the team to look to get Tobias the opportunity to get more and more involved in the offense.
Steve Hinson is our guest. He's the new editor at DetroitBadBoys.com. We're talking about Pistons basketball and their hot start. It all kind of slowed down a little bit last night against the Lakers and Lonzo Ball and the guys. This is a team that we know is capable of really good things. They have a lot of really good young athletes, but they're also very inexperienced. They have not played together very long. Lonzo Ball is a feast or famine kind of guy in his very young career. He feasted last night more than he did not. What happened out there at Staples Center against the Lakers?
Well, we could sort of see when the game started slipping away from the Pistons was when the starters came out, the reserves came on, and they were able to let the Lakers go on a pretty good run. Henry Ellenson had a pretty rough stretch when they made that switch to go to the bench, and the Lakers really just capitalized on it. And you know, that's something that we've seen so far throughout this season, where the Pistons will let the other team go on a run. They'll fall behind, but then they'll just chip away at this lead and just put it into high gear toward the end of the game and just run away with it. And they just didn't have that gear last night. It really just seemed like things just weren't clicking. I don't know if it was just the last game of being on the road, or maybe just putting all of that emotional effort on the line in the Clippers and Warriors games. I can't really speak to what it was that was different about that, but you can really see when things went bad for them was that stretch early on in the first quarter when the bench came out. Was it just seemed like it wasn't going to be the team's night.
Steve Henson, our guest, new editor at DetroitBadBoys.com, talking Pistons basketball, still off to a 5-3 start even with that loss last night. Jim Kushnell's got something for you here. Steve, go ahead, Jim.
And one thing I've been wondering, and it's coincided with the winning these three out of the last four, three in a row, and then the loss last night, was if you flash back to about a week and a half ago, last Monday, they lose to the Sixers, who are, of course, doing better and finally have an actual basketball roster, it seems. And in that game, or after that game, there was some talk that there might be some lineup changes, and the person I pegged was Stanley Johnson, who, quite frankly, was non-existent in the first four games. But in the last four, the three wins at least, Minnesota, Clippers, and Golden State, he was still in the starting lineup. They did not make the change. He scored in double figures in each one, and then in the loss had nine yesterday. What has changed for Stanley Johnson? Because suddenly I don't hear any lineup change talk anymore.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and you know, we talked a little bit about Stanley Johnson possibly coming out of the starting lineup when we chatted on Friday, and I recalled that I think what was driving that talk was he had some tightness in his back, if I remember correctly. And so I think it might have been an injury issue rather than necessarily a performance thing. But, you know, one of the really great things that that we've seen with Stanley this year has been that he has at least been more consistent. He's not going out every night and necessarily being a reliable 13 to 15 point per game type of guy, but that goose egg that he put up in Charlotte, where he was just a disaster on the offensive end, hasn't necessarily been the case. He's been able to tone it down when it's not necessarily his night, but still be able to be confident in his offense to contribute in other ways. But really, the biggest thing with him is he is just such a good defensive player. He has so much potential on that side of the ball that just becoming an adequate offensive player just already makes him a plus guy. He does some really nice things just that are under the radar defensively, where, you know, sometimes he'll just look like Yogi Bear out there stealing a picnic basket with some of these steals where it comes out of nowhere to go and swipe it. But then also just on his individual defense, he might get, there was one point where he was paired up in Golden State in a mismatch with David West. And David West, you know, thought he was going to just go to town on this young guy who he's got a few inches on. And Stanley used that strength to his advantage, held his own, and West ended up putting up just a ridiculous shot. So I think that's the biggest issue with Johnson, is keeping the defense coming, keep bringing that elite defense, and just not be a disaster offensively.
Steve, we're talking to Steve Henson, DetroitBadBoys.com. You wrote an article 2 days ago about the fact that the national media not buying this. They're not all in on the Pistons being, you know, kind of an elite team in the Eastern Conference. They're not even that impressed with what they've done against some of those Western Conference teams, including some very good ones, including the defending champions, excuse me, talking about where they're rated. Why do you think that is, and do you think they're right? Is there a chance that the national writers who look at these teams just see this as a hot start for a team that is moderate in terms of its overall talent, its depth, its ability to carry something like this out over 82 games? They just kind of think that, yeah, they got off to a hot start, good for them, this won't last. Who's right? Are they, or are, you know, Stan Van Gundy and you know, those who are fans of the Pistons, those who read DetroitBadBoys.com, who want to believe in this?
Hey, you know, I think I might have jinxed them with that, though. You know, going and writing that, and then they go get blown out by 20 points to the Lakers. But, you know, one of the things I was thinking about is, hey, we're at 10% of the season right now. It may seem like 8 games is not that much that we should be drawing a conclusion off of, but 10% is, and they're on pace for a 50-win season. They might not be as good as a 50-win season. You know, that would be a great year if they pulled that off. But there's some definitely promising things that we're seeing so far. And also, if we look at that schedule that's coming up, and then we may see the national media start buying in on them. They've got a five-game homestand coming up, and none of these teams they're playing are particularly impressive. These five teams have a combined record so far of 12-22. And so assuming that, you know, it's not one of these seasons where the Pistons are only able to beat the good teams and they just fall apart against the bad ones and they wind up going 2-3 on this stretch or something terrible like that. If they really take advantage of the schedule, and then they could come out of this making believers out of the media.
That's a lot of ifs. What's your gut tell you will be the case? And just for those who don't know the teams you're talking about, it's Milwaukee starting on Friday, Sacramento, mm-hmm. Indiana, Atlanta, Miami are the next five total. So, and then Milwaukee again, just to throw it out there. What's your gut tell you? How do they finish those five games? Are we talking 3-2, 4-1, a little worse?
You know, it's tough to say. Like you said, there's a lot of ifs in there. If I was forced to say, you know, I would hedge my bet going 3-2, but I could absolutely see them wiping, you know, running the table and putting up a five-game win streak. Some of these teams in the East are really bad. So
they are, including the defending Eastern Conference champions right now. What's your view of the Cavaliers, which have owned this division since LeBron James returned from Miami? Again, is it the opposite of the Pistons? Just a slow start, they'll be fine, they'll turn around and do something great, or is there a real reason for concern with that group?
You know, last year I bought into the concern about their defense and was predicting the Raptors or the Celtics going and beating them in the playoffs, and you know, that taught me not to bet against LeBron James. So assuming that Isaiah Thomas is able to come back healthy, I think that the Cavs will take the top spot in the East. I think they're definitely going to be the team to beat. They just do have a lot of firepower. I like some of the gritty players that they did bring in, like Jay Crowder and Isaiah Thomas. So I am going to believe that the Cavs are probably good until they really prove that they're not.
What about the Boston Celtics? Real quick, Kyrie Irving is playing, well, what he wanted to play. You know, he's the ringleader, even without Gordon Hayward after that gruesome injury, who would have clearly been their second-best player. Kyrie Irving has scored 24 points for three straight games. They have won four in a row, and they now actually sit on top of the East along with the Magic, strangely enough, at 5-2. Can the Celtics... Well, let me rephrase. Who are the best teams in the Eastern Conference, not just right now, but going forward, who do you expect them to be? You already kind of outlined the Cavs until you have a reason not to believe in them. But beyond that, is it the Celtics again who ended up with the top seed in the East last year, despite all of the trades and the injury to Gordon Hayward?
You know, I think that if I had to bet between who's going to win in the playoff between the Cavs or the Celtics, I would probably take the Celtics. I would take the Cavs. But the Celtics, they're showing that they're legit. I was a little skeptical with them getting rid of so much toughness in Crowder and in Thomas that was kind of the core of their identity. I was wondering how they would respond to that this season. Would they still have that same defensive mentality, the same toughness that did get them that top seed last year? You know, Kyrie Irving, going from the last pick in the draft to a first pick in the draft, a guy who, you know, is totally undersized for the NBA compared to a guy who is a prototype NBA point guard, would they lose that underdog mentality? And so far, it's been clicking. They've got the best defense in the league. They do have a lot of depth there. Their young players are continuing to show progress. They are, you know, they're going to be a force to contend with in the East. Can they topple the Cavs? I mean, you put them head-to-head, and then I certainly wouldn't be surprised if they were able to pull that off.
Steve Hinson is the new editor at DetroitBadBoys.com, SB Nation's Piston site. You got to follow that. Bookmark that page for your own viewing later on. Make sure that you follow social media as well. Steve Hinson is at Shine. I'm going to try to pronounce it the way it looks. Shineons8, which is S-Hin-On-S-8. So S-H-I-N-O-N-S-8. You got to make that a little more clear. It's harder for me to
hear. Yeah, right.
At least to say it out loud, but we want to give you some follows. Anyway, Steve, great conversation. Thank you so much for the great work you're doing on Detroit Bad Boys, and thanks for coming on with us.
Hey, sure thing. Thanks for taking the time to chat with us, and we appreciate all the support.
Well, we look forward to catching up with you again throughout the season in the stretch run, and then so far in the postseason until last night. So it is really unfortunate. What is amazing, by the way, Jim, you know, people, he had a stretch where his dominance was gone, and it was really up to not this past season, but last season. He had lost some miles per hour off his fastball. People were saying, well, he's in those early 30s where, you know, the wear and tear on an arm and a shoulder sometimes just start to take its effect, and, you know, he doesn't have it anymore. A lot of people believe that, and that's why a lot of people were really amazed and kind of dispirited that he had so much money left on his guaranteed contract for a team, the Tigers, that was going to have to rebuild. And that's what necessitated moving him.
And that's what took so long in moving him, I think, as well.
Exactly. And yet, you know, Fountain of Youth, he's Ponce de Leon. He went down to Florida somehow, found it, the Fountain of Youth. And last night in the World Series at age 34, he was still bringing it at 97, Jim.
Yeah.
He was bringing it at 97 on the gun and mixing that in with some curveballs and doing, you know, Verlander-type things. And it's like, I don't, you know, again, the Indians, as we know, in recent years, last two, 3 years, have found a way to get to Justin Verlander pretty consistently. They beat him up very, very regularly these days. And that started when we said, you know what, he's not Justin Verlander anymore. That heater is topping at 93, 92, et cetera. And then suddenly last year, in which he could have and probably should have won the Cy Young, and this year, in which he will not, but he may win a world championship.
Right.
Those numbers are back up again. That heat is back up again. And I don't know if it's a health thing, if he found, you know, a different training regimen that makes his arms stronger, his shoulders stronger for longer. But all I know is it's, you know, last day of October. He's been pitching like everybody else since pitchers and catchers reported in February. And the wear and tear on a 34-year-old arm, Jim, was not apparent because he was on October 31st hitting 97 in the sixth.
Yeah, exactly. And he's always been that power pitcher in that sense. And it clearly seems to have, you know, revived him a little bit. I mean, we know he it's not that he necessarily wanted to get out of Detroit because he couldn't stand it or anything like that. That's not the case.
No.
In fact, if you recall, there was a talk right as that trade was going down at that proverbial 11th hour that he would veto it. Remember there was a little snafu, if you recall, back on August 31st.
Yeah.
For about 20 minutes span, the reports were that he had vetoed the trade of all things.
That's exactly right. So you know, certainly he did not want to quote unquote get out of town, but we've all kind of surmised, and we discussed this with a few Tigers beat writers, Jim, that competitors like Verlander, when thrust into competitive situations, find a way to kick their games up another
yep.
notch, even at age 34, even if it feels like they've lost their fastball a little bit and that sort of thing, and that he might revive himself if he goes into a situation like this. And my God, he did. He has done exactly that, even with the loss yesterday to fall to 0-4 in the World Series in his career. He has done that from his time, literally since he first went and put that starred cap instead of that old English D
yep.
on the top of his
head. And quite frankly, I'll go ahead and say something that doesn't matter about tonight necessarily, and for Verlander specifically, it won't, because you won't see him tonight. He pitched
right.
six innings yesterday. But by having him sign, regardless of how much cash it's going to cost the Astros, by having him sign for two more years, you could argue that the tip-top of the Houston Astros rotation is just as good or even better than the Indians when you got two Cy Young aces in Verlander and Keuchel, and one's a righty and one's a lefty to boot. So that's going to be a challenge for anyone in the American League, you know, coming up next year. If you play the Astros in like a three-game series and two of the starts are going to be Verlander and Keuchel, you're just hoping to get one win out of those that type of series in that situation.
Totally
so
agree.
It sets up the Astros even more when they start fresh from the beginning and have a whole season of Verlander. With them.
I totally agree. That's a very good point. It's a very fair point. And by the way, you will not see Justin tonight, as you pointed out, in Game 7, but you will see a couple of other aces, including Keuchel and, yes, Clayton Kershaw. Clayton Kershaw, who has become essentially Peyton Manning, and I've got to think there's some other people whose regular season dominance has not been reflected in their postseason performance. Peyton Manning, of course, put up all of the best numbers in the history of the league in terms of single season, this and that, but his playoff record is right around 500. He's got a couple of Super Bowls, but the second one we know was not necessarily vintage Peyton. Some of the showdowns in the postseason with Tom Brady always went Tom Brady's way. Clayton Kershaw was that and worse. In fact, was just flat out far worse than that. He could not hold a lead in game number four, in which he pitched, or five, I beg your pardon, and he pitched on his regular rest. That was that 13-12 game. He pitched on a regular rest. He was not short, you know, he was not pitching on short rest. And he could not hold a 3-0 lead, and then he could not hold a 4-run lead. He just does not have the ability, and I hate to make it sound like this, when you have a career regular season ERA among the best of all time, I'm talking the best of all time, his career ERA, Jim, is 2.36.
That's nuts in modern baseball.
In modern baseball, thank you. in modern baseball, through all of the different offensive explosions that we have seen, he is a witch. And yet when it comes to the postseason, he doesn't do it. He doesn't have it. In that loss in game five, he didn't take the loss, but he pitched 4 2/3 innings, gave up 6 earned runs and 3 walks, and did not and could not and was not able to seal the deal for his team. In this 2017 postseason, it's been very similar to his other postseasons. He has an ERA in 5 appearances, Jim, of 4.34, almost double that regular season ERA of 2.31. It's just it's inexplicable. And the only thing he can do, Jim, to salvage his legacy as a big game, big time postseason pitcher is come out tonight in relief of Yu Darvish. He will pitch. Darvish will start, probably won't go more than 3 or 4. And if you remember, Darvish got banged around in his first start in this series. And if he gets in trouble again, Kershaw will come in earlier, and he will be pitching on short rest. But he needs to pitch, you know, 2 or 3 or 4, however many innings he can give them, in dominant fashion, hold the Astros to nothing, and contribute to a Dodgers win in order to salvage his growing reputation as a regular season superstar Hall of Famer and a postseason flop.
Yeah, no doubt about it there. And I've been wondering all day of the percentage chance, because how you laid out what the Dodgers would approach tonight's game, especially if Darvish gets in any trouble early with bringing in a Kershaw. I've been wondering all day, and I'm at about 50-50 that this could happen, because it also requires Kershaw to actually perform. Is what are the chances he pulls a Madison Bumgarner? Remember that other road win?
Well, that's
in
what he would have to
recently?
Do.
He'd have, that was Bumgarner throw. What was it, 6 no hit innings or whatever the heck it was?
No, I think it was four or five.
It was a 5 inning save.
In reserve,
it was
a 5
inning save. Yeah,
right, correct. Yeah, he would have to do that in order to salvage his reputation and burnish his credentials as a Hall of Famer with postseason success. He would have to undo the damage that he did in Game 5 to his legacy by pitching 4 or 5 innings of shutout ball tonight in a win, in a series clincher, a championship clincher, just like Bumgarner. You're 100% right. That's what it would take for him to do. All right, that's it. That's all the time that we got. Don't forget, I told you I was going to hook you up, and I am. On the way out the door, caller 5. Caller 5, 866-240-1065. Call right now. Talk to Jim Cushlin. He's going to set you up with a pair of tickets to Joe Bonamassa on Monday, the 27th of November at Stranahan. Then you've got Mr. Mike Miller coming your way. Drive Time is next. Don't go anywhere. Stay right here on the team.